Good people, it is official. Guess Who's Coming to Radio is now 3 hours. Every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m., we will continue to use the airwaves as a tool of positivity, awareness, and proactivity. We have a platform, and we intend to use it to encourage liberation. Many of us in the struggle for African liberation need a positive soundtrack. So music and words which feed the mind, body, and spirit are welcome here. Your support all these years have moved us to always strive to do better radio. And now you get one more hour. Again, stay tuned every second and fourth Thursday from 7 to 10 p.m. for Guess Who's Coming to Radio on KBOO, your community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Step House Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Step House Internet Services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net. Also, thanks to Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffeehouse.
Good morning. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. My guest is Oregon author Robert Hill. Welcome to KBOO, Robert.
Thank you very much.
Robert Hill has worked as a writer in advertising, entertainment, educational software, and not-for-profit fundraising. His first novel is When All Is Said and Done, which was shortlisted for the Oregon Book Awards Ken Kesey Award for Fiction. He received a Portland Literary Arts Walt Morey Fellowship and a Breadloaf Writers Conference Fellowship. Today we're going to focus on his latest novel, The Remnants, which is set in the town of New Eden, an isolated agrarian community in its last days. It tells the stories of the townfolk in that community, many of whom are getting through the effects of generations of inbreeding. Robert, let's talk a little bit about your background as a writer. You made a big change in your life going from writing in the business and nonprofit world to writing fiction. Can you talk a little bit about that transition and maybe a little about how it informed your creative writing?
I worked in movie advertising for many, many years, doing some of the other things, educational software, et cetera. And I had gotten sick of doing the three-word headline. All of my work was short blurbs. So when I sat down to write my first novel, which came about because of what I call a creative intervention by some friends who thought I was just spinning my wheels, and I felt I was just spinning my wheels and wanted to do something much more soul-nourishing. My first novel, which came out very voicey, has a 4-page first sentence. And it was my declaration of independence over the three-word headline.
That's quite a declaration.
Yes. And I hadn't written prose fiction for 20, 25 years, but it was time I felt mature enough. You know, I know a lot of writers who are mature at 20, and I didn't feel I was at 20 to write about real human substance other than just a story.
I mean, I could see how the work that you did would be valuable in some ways, but also maybe deadening in some ways, too.
It was fun, and I liked the cleverness that's called for, but it's very repetitive, and it's very superficial. You want to convey the memory of the experience when you're writing for a film, and that's really it in three words.
In the introduction that I just read, I summarized this novel, The Remnants, as taking place in this isolated community. It's the last days of the community. And I wasn't quite sure if that was a good summary. What do you say when you want people to know in a quick sentence?
It's the last few elderly people in a small dying town and what they bring with them of the collective history of the town to the end of their lives.
There are three characters that sort of span the whole book and become very important at the end, but there are many characters in this book.
Right.
How how was that to write about so many different people?
It was fun. I didn't plan ahead to do it. I had the character of True Bliss as my first hook, and she came about because I heard a voice, and I knew who she was from that voice.
And she's the character that we hear at the very beginning
of
the book.
And then there was a named narrator originally, who was her cousin, named Sisyphus Bliss. And early on, he very wisely wrote himself out of the story because the story was becoming too blurred through his focus, and I didn't like that. I really wanted a God's eye view of this town, and the more I understood what I was writing, the more appropriate that became.
So True Bliss, you mentioned that you heard a voice. Mm-hmm. Was it her voice?
It was her voice. It was a voice that I attributed to her. And I knew from that voice what she said did not make it into the novel because it has nothing to do with the novel. It simply told me that she was in dementia. And her voice related to, I had a house that had a small, old, arthritic apple orchard. And I knew that the voice was connected to that orchard represented a dying world. I think those arthritic trees really inspired the whole inbreeding. You know, the limbs were all awry, the apples were small and deformed.
And by the time of the end of the book, True Bliss is 100, and the other two striking characters,
Kennesaw Belvedere, whose birthday it is. That's really the only action of the on the surface. Mm-hmm. It's his 99th birthday, and True is hosting her annual tea for him. And the following day, she will turn 100, but she doesn't like to celebrate that with anybody. She prefers to celebrate that with herself. And the third character is Hunko Minton. Herkimer is his real name. And he is jealous that this tea is taking place, and he is not part of it. And this is the year, finally, when he will stop it.
Well, the book does begin with that.
Yes.
Did you have that in mind, that whole arc, that would, that's what you were leading to when you started the book?
No. I had a vague idea where I wanted the book to end. I did not know how I was going to get there. I didn't know really what was going to go on in between. I build it sentence to sentence, which is why I'm such a slow writer.
The voice is very distinctive in this book. And one of the feelings that I had when reading it at first was, is it a fairy tale or a fable of some kind? Partly because I think of the voice and the language, but also because this town, New Eden, is so undefined as far as when it is taking place, where it is. Mm-hmm. Did you want that?
I did want that. I didn't know the name of the town until I was working on one of my long sentences, aiming for an end, aiming for it to land, and I landed on New Eden. And that's when I understood what the book was about. I went, oh, now I see it, that this was supposed to be the negative to the positive of Eden, New Eden, from the beginning to the end.
Earlier we talked about what I perceived as possibly a fairy tale aspect or fable aspect of The Remnants. Is there more that you can say about that and how you respond to that idea?
The language from the start was a little old-fashioned and elevated in a way, which began to influence the story. And I realized that it was sounding fairy tale-ish, and that was okay with me. And early on, I realized, like True Grimm's fairy tales, there's that very dark element to them. You know, Cinderella's stepsisters get their eyes chewed out by the crows, things like that. So I started to build that in. And it wasn't calculated. It just became a natural thing. And really, it was True Bliss's birth you know, that her father goes off and drowns before her mother goes into labor. That began it. It became comical but very real to me. And that dark element seemed like the right balance to the language. And I think it's what ultimately made the language and the funny names work and resonate on a much deeper level. You laugh, ha, 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 at the names, but then you get in and you go, oh, oh my. And then they're real people. Then it's flesh and blood. Then it's things that you can identify with and feel sorry for and empathize and, yeah. Yeah.
It must have been an interesting balance to have those elements that are almost unreal,
mm-hmm.
but to make them real, to have that challenge of making them, making the reader
yes.
want to respond.
And I didn't want it to ever stray into any kind of magical realism, anything like that, or ridiculous funny, because I think that would have defeated the purpose of these lives. I didn't want people to laugh at them, with them maybe, but not at them.
So this might be a good time to hear a short passage from the book, just to give people a little bit of the flavor of the writing in The Remnants. Would you read a passage for us?
Certainly. This is from a chapter, a Kennesaw chapter. About two-thirds of the way through the book, but it speaks to a broader theme in the novel. There are acts that happen upon us and moments that happen for no reason, and if we are to survive what comes our way to finish our rotations around the sun while feeling the sun for its warmth as well as its scorching, then we who are able must deliver ourselves from the aftermath to where we need to go. It was true with the serpent in the garden, and it has been true ever since. The snake bite is not what defines a life. What defines it is how we extract the venom.
Hmm. So that gets sort of to the idea of the New Eden
mm-hmm.
that we were just talking about, and what these characters sort of have in common.
Mm-hmm. As they fill their time with how they can. They do the best that they can with what they've been given in this last bit of life
right.
for this town.
Why don't people leave? More people leave. There are some people that venture out of New Eden.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't more people leave?
This is all they know. This is familiar to them. Why do so many people cling to a small dying town when there are no jobs left? When there are no resources, it's their world. Their families have been there for generations. It doesn't seem right, in a way, to have to leave one's home. And then there comes a point where you are glued to the land that you were born on. And in spite of any reasonable thoughts, you stay.
Right.
Against your own better, against your own best interests, you stay.
Did you grow up in a small town?
I grew up in a small, affluent town. It was the country, but it was considered a bedroom community to New York City. So it was lots of artists and oh. actors and writers and
so a lot different.
Advertising, yeah.
Not in New Eden.
No, but it had been a town. It had been a farm town where there were still families in that town that were there from the early 1700s. They were the last of those families. So I understood that. I understood finding cow skulls in woods that had been fields. So the sense of history, living history that goes on.
I'm speaking with Robert Hill. We're talking about his novel, The Remnants, on Between the Covers. Going back a little bit to the theme of inbreeding, and you mentioned the trees, the gnarled trees inspired that. And I just wanted to touch on a defining event in the life of the character True Bliss is when she turns away a suitor that she was quite interested in when she realizes they probably had the same father.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The echoes of that are forever for her.
Mm-hmm.
All the people in the book are somehow, like we said at the beginning, somehow marked by this incredible insulation and isolation. Mm-hmm. And at some point she says, this has to stop. This stops with us. Can you talk a little bit about that, about her character and that attitude?
Well, she's considered the, you know, kind of the head of the town, being that she is the oldest of this last generation of people. And you would think that it's born out of bitterness that she says this has to stop, but it's really out of practicality. Her mother was right. Her mother said, you can't date this man. You cannot marry this man. And what would happen would be what did happen. There was one child born to cousins, first cousins, and she became the cautionary tale. Well, because it is an isolated town away from mainstream world, the things that would be considered taboo in the mainstream world don't really apply here. The same way that normal names don't really apply here. In a normal world, you may name a girl Daisy, but in this world, if you're going to name her after a flower, you name her Columbine. Mm-hmm. So in that regard, there is a character who was born to parents. The father was referred to as regular a man as ever wound a ball of string, and they discovered that in the wife a small knot was growing, and they named her Knotsy, Knotsy, which means nothing to them, means everything awful to us. And that was intentional when I got to that, to display that difference between the mainstream and this small world in a harder-edged way than just, you know, the unusual names of the other ones, which are kind of funny and cute. Mm-hmm. And this one stops you because of its, because of our connotation to the other spelling. So True realizes this, you know, this can't continue. And she knows that there's something probably going on between the brother and sister.
Carnival
and Jubilee Aspetuck. It's intentionally vague. You don't really know if that's what happened. That's her suspicion. And it's not for me to say. I wanted it to be vague.
There is a passage in the book that where the expression is that life in New Eden is about following your instincts, mm-hmm. where the day takes you mm-hmm. is about following your instincts. And mm-hmm. I think you know what I'm talking about. Can you talk about the role of following instincts in the remnants?
Well, you don't have prescribed roles for anybody in this town. You don't have the industrial world influencing things. So the day is simply whatever you want to make of it. And because there aren't jobs necessarily, you know, people have their gardens and they're more or less self-sustaining. So, you know, symbolizing that really is the Drell family. Rutherford Drell, his son Rufus Drell, Rufus's son Rue Drell, and Rue's dog Ruff. And all they do is walk daily across the contours of the town. They never go beyond it. And every day they could be walking the same pattern every day, but every day the landscape is just a little bit different. Seasonally, it's very different. But what was blooming one day could be at its end of its cycle the next day, so therefore it is different. And they appreciate that, the day for what it can be. You know, there's certainly no television and cell phones or anything like that. And yet, at a point, you do realize the industrial world has been happening.
Yeah.
And they had been part of it at one time, and then it just got cut off, and it didn't matter that it got cut off. Really. Because their lives were at the end of their lives anyway. And they chose to simply live that out in that fashion.
It must have been interesting for you to sort of imagine what that would
mm-hmm.
be like.
Mm-hmm.
How life would be lived.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a post-apocalyptic kind of thing without doomsday informing the story.
Right.
It's a different kind of doom.
Do you have a favorite character in the book?
Possibly Hunko, because he simply is who he is.
T- Tell us a little more about Hunko.
Hunko is a rough little guy. He builds the coffins. He knows who he is. And he waits his whole life to get what he wants. And what he wants is very simple. What he wants is what everyone wants, to love and be loved. And he's willing to wait his whole life.
And it's a long life.
And it's a long life.
Yeah. You are in the Tom Spanbauer's writing group? Is
I that? Was, yes.
You were.
I wrote my first novel in Dangerous Writers.
Can you talk about that, how that group influenced your writing? Maybe it influenced that book more than this book? Or?
Well, the greatest thing about that group was that I gained confidence to write because of that group. I was terrified going in there. I started off on a Tom's three-day weekend seminar. I got the last space in it. Friends had convinced me, you should do this. They were in Tom's workshop. I knew Chuck Palahniuk from the gym for many years. I knew he had been in Tom's workshop. And I went into that weekend terrified because, as I said, I hadn't written prose fiction, 25-something years, and what I had written was, you know, juvenile nothing. So at the end of that weekend, Tom invited me to join the workshop. And I could feel my feet going out from under me because I knew this was going to be something dangerous, literally dangerous for me, because I was going to have to put out in a way that I hadn't had to professionally. And the nature of his workshop is, you know, for the first few weeks, months sometimes, you're sitting on the periphery of the room. There's a central table where everyone participates, but newcomers sit on the outside and observe. And you don't actually get to say anything, you don't get to critique, and you certainly don't bring in your own work. And then one day, Tom points to you in the shadows, and he says, next week, you bring pages. And there couldn't have been a better device for me to get me to create. And my first novel came out of the small piece that I had worked on that three-day weekend, which was I wrote about the night before my father died. And I had never written about it before. I hadn't really thought about it before, you know, except in years of therapy. So, but not in terms of putting it down on paper. So when I came in with my first pages, and they were very different than Tom's style of writing and from the style of writing that most of the people in the room shared. And there were some great writers in that room. And I thought, they're going to hate me. But I was trying to do what Tom talked about in terms of, you know, where he talks about going on the body, where he talks about unpacking a moment, things like that. I was trying to do his things, but in my language, because that was the language I knew. I knew how to play with words because I'd been doing it, bending them for so many years in advertising. Right. And I enjoyed that part of writing. So when I would come in each week with something new, it was such a surprise to me, first and foremost, that this was coming out of me. And then to have this table of people respond to it with such affirmation, it was incredible for me. I could never duplicate that experience. It's why when I ultimately left the group after I finished my first novel, it was because that was a perfect world to me. Mm. And I never wanted to jeopardize that, taint it in any way with any other experience. That was perfect. Yeah.
That's like quite a gift, I guess.
It was a thrilling experience. That room and that kind of camaraderie, and it's very safe. And if you're critiquing, you're critiquing work. You're not critiquing soul, you know. And a lot of people are writing what's more or less autobiographical material, fictionalizing it. Right. You know, so you can very easily tear off the skin. Sometimes there were writers who were so close to the material that they couldn't allow themselves the distance, and so it became difficult to critique the work itself because they took that personally as you were criticizing their life. And that was rare because everyone in the room is really attentive to the work, how a person in their voice will tell that story. And everybody would be pushed in a different way. and you see each individual strength, and then you encourage that strength.
That's a real skill, I think.
Yes.
I read something that you said, talking about tapping into the inside of mm-hmm. yourself to mm-hmm. write fiction. Is that similar to what you did in that workshop, or is that something?
Well, absolutely, because when I would work on my chapters, I don't observe a very disciplined writing schedule. I don't write every day. I write in bursts. And I've described it as like a dog circling a bowl of new food. I circle the keyboard until I'm willing to commit, or until I am so angry at myself for not committing that I commit. And then I force my fingers to type out that first sentence. Often I don't know what that sentence is. It's when they are typed and I'm saying them, because I write out loud most of the time as I'm typing. I realize, oh, that's what I'm thinking about. And then I have to stay with it until I finish whatever the arc is that I feel is the arc. It could be a sentence, it could be a paragraph, it could be a chapter. But I have to stay with it. It could be 15 hours that I have to stay with that until I am satisfied that I've hit all the notes that I want.
Like music.
Like music, yeah. It's why I keep saying it out loud over and over. I have to hear the rhythm of it. I have to hear certain words and how they brush up against each other. And then I have to hear how, because I build in lots of little repeating, almost choruses in my sentences. So I have to hear how those work, how those individually land, and how the entire thing then lands with those things built in. So I'm pretty wrung out for one of those sessions. But I feel great. That to me is the essence of writing, because the entire time that I'm doing that, I'm surprising myself with what's coming out. I am delighting myself. I am. If I'm crying as I'm writing it, and I did not expect that at all, I'm thrilled, you know, because I feel I'm writing something true. Something that resonates, hopefully for others. I can't control that, but I can only control what I am doing, and I don't want to control in that sense. I don't want to inhibit myself or censor myself as I'm writing. So if all those emotions are being activated, that is great. That's a great writing experience to me. And it has nothing to do with publishing, and it has nothing to do with readers. It is the writer in the moment creating. That works for me. I can't speak for other people, but that's what it means to me. It's like a very hot love affair.
Oh.
Where the chemistry just works out of nowhere. Now, that's hard to duplicate each time. You know, so I don't have 15-hour sex with my writing every time I sit down to do it. Sometimes it's nothing. The equipment's not working. Next.
Has working in this style, this unique style for this novel, has it affected where you're going next? Or are you, again, going in some totally different direction, do you think?
Well, it's a little different direction, but, you know, all my novels have to do with connecting. So, and this new one is about connecting. My sentences are still long. I do love my run-on sentences, but that's life to me. And it makes sense to me. I don't do them frivolously. There's more air in this new novel, I think. Right now there is. It's going to go to a very hard place, and I don't know what the air in that room's going to be like yet. Yeah. But right now, I am making light of what is really a horrible kind of childhood for the protagonist. And a family in which there are no boundaries. And so I'm building all of the elements, all those plates are in the air.
Well, I really appreciate you talking about this with me, this novel, The Remnants, and your process and ideas. You know, it's just a very interesting read, you grow along with the book, I think, as a reader. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
I want to let people know again that I've been speaking with Robert Hill, and we've been talking about his latest book, which is The Remnants, on KBOO Portland, on Between the Covers. If you missed part of this interview or want to hear it again, It will be available on the KBOO website later today. Just go to kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. This is Kathleen Stevenson. Thanks for listening.
Come over here to the right-hand speaker.
KBOO's book and record sale is happening August 13th at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street, starting at noon. Find treasures amongst the stacks of donated items while raising money for KBOO, your very own community radio station.
Friction between the stylus and the record produces a force which makes the arm try to swing towards the record center.
Again, that's KBOO's book and record sale, Saturday, August 13th from noon to 7 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Coot Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm now standing in the center, and my voice should be located precisely midway between the speakers.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.